as we've done for the last several years here at KXCI, in order to honor International Women's Day and also the women in our local community, we've got Maggie Zanger, professor of journalism at the University of Arizona, Middle East expert, and extensive journalist and writer. Maggie, I'm turning it over to you.
Great. Thanks, Marianne. And welcome, everyone, to KXCI's International Women's Day. This is about the fourth year we've facilitated a discussion to honor this day. KXCI always has this programming on the Sunday before, and then they will rebroadcast it again on March 8th. In the past, we've had panels of Tucson-based women who were largely from other countries who could talk to us about the experiences of women around the world, in Iran, in Afghanistan, in Guatemala, Turkey. We're really fortunate in that way to have a diverse community in Tucson. We are a resettlement community, and of course we have lots of folks from south of the border. But this year, we decided to focus a little closer to home on the U.S.-Mexican border and also in the U.S. and in Arizona. I think a lot of women in the U.S. are feeling a little bit under siege these days, especially women of color, gay women, low-income women, Native Americans, migrants. And so we kind of think it's a time for all of us to stand together and support each other as we face a new administration and face some possibly rough waters ahead with a president who seems to be fairly hostile to women of all types and stripes. So let me today first introduce you to the women who have come down on this lovely Sunday afternoon to talk with us. First is Rose Lopez, who is the president and CEO of Intermountain Centers for Human Development. This is a Tucson-based nonprofit that provides a large number of programs and services for people throughout southern Arizona who are dealing with mental illness, developmental disabilities, and other challenges, like myself. She's a member of the Tono Alto Nation, our neighbors to the east and south of Tucson, and is also an Army veteran. Anything you want to add to that description, Rose, before I move on to our other guests?
No, I think you covered that well, Maggie.
Good. Well, welcome. We're glad you're here today. And now I'll introduce Linda Green, who is a professor of anthropology and the former director of the Center for Latin American Studies at the University of Arizona. Her research centers on women, migration, and violence, particularly among indigenous peoples in the Americas. Linda Green has and still conducts field research with rural Guatemala, along the U.S.-Mexican border and in rural Alaska, which I'm hoping is your summertime research. So welcome, Linda.
Thank you.
I missed in your introduction?
No, thanks so much.
All right, great. So we'll move on to Ana Ochoa O'Leary, who's the head of Mexican American Studies at the U of A, and she's published a lot in both English and Spanish on migration and gender, including Women at the Intersection, Immigration Enforcement and Transnational Migration on the U.S.-Mexico Border, which traces migrant women's encounters with immigration enforcement agents, which I think is a really relevant topic right now. A lot has come out recently about, which we know has been going on for a long time, but a lot has come out recently about the treatment of people on the border. Law enforcement agents. She was also the editor of Undocumented Immigrants in the U.S., an encyclopedia of their experience. So as you can see, we have a lot of expertise here and interest in migration and in women, and with a solid focus on the U.S.-Mexico border region and indigenous people, which is where we live. So we'll be talking about forced migration, violence against women, reproductive rights, the heightened vulnerabilities of indigenous women and women of color. So before turning to these issues of forced migration and the many undocumented immigrants in our country who are threatened now, I think, with deportation, we kind of want to start on a more positive note, which would be the Women's March that took place on January 21st. Did you want to say something, Linda? No, okay. But the Women's March in January, the day after Donald Trump was inaugurated as the 45th president of the United States, so far, all 45 white men. The Women's March, I thought, was a bit of a triumph. Here in Tucson, I really felt It was upbeat. There were a diverse representation from the community. A lot of women with their children, their colleagues, their friends, their partners. A lot of men marching in support. I don't know why that surprised me, but I thought it was really nice to see so many men on the streets of downtown Tucson. Even more impressive, I thought, were the huge numbers of women around the world who are marching in solidarity with American women. This reportedly is the largest protest march in history. Some 4.1 million in the U.S. alone, which seems a high figure to me, but this is according to a couple of political scientists from the University of Connecticut and the University of Denver who have been compiling this huge spreadsheet listing march turnouts around the world, everywhere from the 1 million people in Los Angeles to the single protester who picketed in Sholo, Arizona, and we're proud of her, whoever she is, and even eight of my Kurdish sisters in the Kurdish capital of Erbil in Iraq. There were supposedly more than 300,000 women in 300 cities globally marching with women on January 21st, which I think is really quite impressive. And Rose, why such a big turnout? I mean, usually it's American women who are in solidarity with women in developing countries and in more troubled areas. What do you think's going on that there were so many people around the world who were on the march?
Well, Maggie, I for one was very impressed with the Women's March. It was so nice to see the number of women come out. I think that the recent election in the United States really was a wake-up call for women. And I think, you know, we've made such great progress over the years, albeit not enough, and we have a long ways to go. I think we all realize that there is so much more that we need to do as women in ensuring that our rights are equal to men and to anyone else, specifically when it comes to minority women, I think. In regards to Anna, what we saw across the world, which was really nice, I think, you know, the United States of America is a model when it comes to women's rights.
Linda, do you want to add anything to that? Were women of color represented enough?
There were certainly women of color there. I thought not as many as one would love to see, but perhaps that might have to do with the current president's stance on immigration and migrant women and people without documents fear to come up. What I did want to say too about the support, the international support, is I think people, women, everyone in countries around the world realize that when something happens in the United States, particularly a change of political power that does not seem for many of us a very positive way, that can have real repercussions on their lives, because the United States is such a powerful nation and impinges on the lives of everyone everywhere. I think women around the world saw Donald Trump as the threat he is, just like we do in the United States, particularly for women, but for all people who are vulnerable, all people who are not rich.
Well, and I think we saw that right away with his ending of the birth control option for USAID. There'll be no more funding for any organization that provides abortions around the world, which means no more money for other forms of birth control. We've seen this many times with Republican presidents, but that was like an opening shot. Mm-hmm. And for President Trump. But one of the questions I have is, has this momentum from January 21st been maintained? Are we still moving forward? Now, March 8th, is supposed to be, which is International Women's Day, as we said before, is supposed to be a day without women. Women around the world are supposed to remove themselves from the economy to protest not just Donald Trump, but more generally the barriers that keep women from achieving equality. Organizers say they'll be striking to end gender violence, to protest reproductive freedom, to preserve the environment and natural resources, to secure equal pay for equal work, to guarantee a $15 minimum wage and paid family and sick leave, and to create a social system that works for everybody. Now, this is a very broad broad agenda, and it seems to me that the women's agenda has broadened to include all these issues that are important to families and to women and to girls. Anna, what do you think? Has the momentum been maintained? Are people aware of this coming up on March 8th?
Well, I'm not sure how much they're aware, which is why a session such as this on KXCI is really important, because, this is one day, one broadcast in which we are being asked to reflect on how gender roles and women's achievements have evolved, you know, how they evolve within this larger macro structural conditions such as a presidential election. So although I have to say that, you know, the commitment to gender issues shouldn't be a once a year event. I think for those of us who have the commitment to highlight the important roles of women, it's incumbent on us to kind of keep that flame alive. So we need to make it a daily habit, and we need to profess as much as possible to those around us. So a general strike or something like International Women's Day, I think it's a good time to revisit those ideas that made this particular event possible. It's no coincidence that International Women's Day began in the 1900s when there was this angst over working conditions for women. Women were entering the labor force. Women were also were recognizing that there was great inequalities in the workforce in terms of wages, in terms of treatment, harassment, violence on the workforce. So at the same time, this was a good time to point out their contributions. And without recognizing those contributions, women will always be in the danger of being invisible and relegated to the shadows. And as long as they're relegated to the shadows, they will also always be victims of violence, of discrimination, of being made invisible, having a voice. And so this is a good time to again revisit our efforts to raise awareness about gender disparities, including women's rights, reproductive rights, the rights to vote, our right to be heard, our right to seek social justice. Otherwise, then we might have this booming great economy, I don't care how great, but we'll always have the inequalities that will make things unequal for women.
Well, and I think what we've seen in the past couple decades is an increasing gap between rich and poor. And so, you know, working class women are much worse off, I think, than they were in the 60s or 70s. I mean, so while professional women may have made some strides, I think this gap with rich getting richer and richer and poor moving down is something that is of concern. Rose, I know it's a concern of yours in your work.
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, an organization like Intermountain Centers, we work with families who are often single parent homes. And part of what we see is the income gap, and that and we see the result of that. I think that's really probably one of the most concerning areas for me, is that, you know, over the last 15 years, there's been this widening of the rich and the poor, and the gap has just really increased. And I think there is the potential for that to even get wider, which is very unfortunate. But, you know, going back to the march and the discussion, and will this continue? I mean, you know, we're big cheerleaders, and we're going out there and we're having discussions, we're participating in everything. You know, I want to say it's up to us as women to keep the conversation going. And, you know, we have a lot of leaders within this community. We have, you know, there are leaders in every community. And really, I think for me, I mean, I definitely want to keep the discussion going. And every opportunity I have to have a discussion or to participate in what's going on around social issues and so forth regarding women, I'm going to participate. And I think, again, it's up to us as women to be able to keep the conversation going.
Great. And that's one of the reasons why we're here today on KXCI Community Radio. 91.3 in downtown Tucson to talk about International Women's Day and issues of concern to women in this community and our sisters around the world. Linda, what would you like to add to that?
I mean, just want to say, in terms of the momentum, I think, you know, the march and perhaps whatever's going to happen on International Women's Day are really important symbolic features for people. And it reminds all of us that together, as part of a group, there are things we can do. And I think what's also been spurred more and more publicly is smaller groups getting together, which are now starting to develop leadership among just ordinary people, ordinary women, where before, you know, the divide you talk about, Rose, economically, has also been very entrenched politically. Who has the right to speak? Who has the right to organize? So I think there's lots of things coming about, particularly with regard to youth. And I see on the campus in Arizona, I mean, I'm so impressed by so many of our undergraduate and graduate students, and many of them are women, who are coming to the fore, starting to create a leadership that's not based on hierarchy, but on consensus. So I think these public events are really important to galvanize us, but the work is in smaller groups of communities addressing key issues of people's lives.
Well, and also it seems there's been quite a move to encourage women and people who are normally outside of leadership structures to run for office. And I think we saw conservative people were very effectively using school boards, moving up to city council, boards of supervisors, state legislatures, and moving people up through their ranks. And, you know, when I think about the possibility of running for office, it's such a daunting task. And I've seen people struggle with it. It's not an easy thing to do. It's all encompassing. But I think it's something that women have to do, and women and people of color, everyone who's been left out of this hierarchy of power structures, needs to get busy and needs to get working. Anna, would you agree with that? Or
I totally agree with that, and I think it's really important for those women who can run for office. Not to lose sight of the important changes in our society that have caused the widening gap of poverty. We've talked a lot about neoliberal models that are applied to our society that have been for generations now being applied to societies from where women are migrating. So as women migrate and they're impoverished, they are expected to resolve those economic issues by working, by entering the labor force. And certainly, you know, if we look at life and the way that we put things into priorities, you know, their priorities is to survive. So the priorities of other women should be to advocate for them, provide that voice for those who cannot run for office. And I think it's really important right now. We're living in this neoliberal moment where more and more support services are being taken away from people who need it the most. This was practiced with the neoliberal policies such as NAFTA and CAFTA that created impoverished populations who had no choice but to migrate. So we are part of the problem, and unless we fix those problems, then we ourselves, by our inaction, are part of the problem and making the problem bigger, in fact.
Great. Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because I want us to move now to talk a little bit more about migration and issues of forced migration. And these undocumented people, I mean, we have people who do have asylum, who have refugee status in our country, but we have a lot of people who are undocumented, and they are the most vulnerable. And right now they are really vulnerable. And I think living in very fearful conditions. And I think that's a group of people we really have a responsibility to work with and to try to protect. And, you know, last year when we did this, we dedicated the International Women's Day panel that we did last year to women who were on the move, to women who had been forced to migrate. And, you know, right now, actually, as of 2015, there's 244 million people who are living in countries other than those they were born in. And this is a 41% increase just from 2000. I mean, this is a huge number. There's huge numbers of people on the move, and in good part, in our part of the world, from these policies that Anna was just talking about with NAFTA, and that have not worked for people at in other countries and have forced them. And so, you know, this is something I've done a lot of work on in the Middle East. And, of course, Linda and Anna have both done a lot of work on forced migration. So I thought, Linda, maybe you can talk a little bit about what compels people. So to pick up from what Anna was saying, what compels people to leave and start this arduous journey? I can't imagine making this journey.
Yeah, I'd like to start a little bit before Anna's neoliberal model, and particularly looking at the Northern Triangle countries, Guatemala, Salvador, and Honduras, where the vast majority of the women seeking asylum are coming from across our southern border, to talk about not only the 1980s violence, the civil wars in those countries, but also to start back in 1954 with the U.S. overthrow of the democratically elected government of Jacobo Arbenz in Guatemala, and then the 1960s counterinsurgency training and funding of death squads at the government level and the paramilitary level to look at this whole trajectory of U.S. interference in those countries, making them now absolutely unlivable. Certainly NAFTA and CAFTA, the impunity in all of those countries, for example, in Guatemala, for genocide against Mayan women. No one's paid a price for that. No one's been held accountable, even though kudos to the Guatemalan court for being the first country in the world to try one of the military men on genocide, Efraín Ríos Montt. He was convicted and then quickly overturned. But also to bring it up to the present, I'm working with a lot of women who are seeking asylum from Guatemala. Well, when the surge happened in 2014, President Barack Obama, then president, put into effect the Alliance for Prosperity, that is a billion-dollar package to create the conditions at home of why women wouldn't migrate. But mostly, more than half of that money went to the military for security. So you have people living in incredibly impoverished positions. For example, in Guatemala, 90% of the Mayan people live in poverty. It's overrun by drug trafficking organizations, impunity for that counterinsurgency war, extractive industries on indigenous lands without their permission. So this is the kind of situation women are fleeing, and they are the recipients of domestic violence, of violence against women, in which now those three countries are in the top five in the world for femicide, the killing of women simply because they are women.
Rose, do you have something to add to that?
Yes. You know, my personal story, you know, I'm a member of the Tohono O'odham Nation. And my mother was actually born on the Mexican side of the nation. And so she came to the United States for opportunity. And I think that there are many immigrants who come to the U.S. because of that opportunity. My mother lived in the United States for many years as an undocumented immigrant. And I couldn't imagine if I were a child and all of a sudden there was forced immigration and she had not received her documents to stay here. I couldn't imagine what that would have done to my family. But it was the opportunity that she needed in order to be able to build her family and to be able to rear her kids. And, you know, I come from a strong single parent home, and you know, I myself, you know, like to think that I'm successful, and I attribute that to the values that I received from my mother. And so I think it's really about the opportunity to be able to better your life.
So there's both the push factors and the pull factors, and you were talking about some of the pushing from Central America, mm-hmm. and you're talking about the things that attract people. But I think, why did we see such a surge of women a couple of years ago. Why did that happen? I mean, we traditionally, and we've seen this in the Middle East too, traditionally men go ahead because it is such a dangerous journey. Men go ahead, they get established, they make money, they bring their family. And that has all been turned on its ear, I think, in a number of countries. And Linda, why is that from Central America? Why did we see at that time such a surge?
Well, I think there might be a couple reasons in issues at work. One, it's reached such a level in those countries of violence. In all three of those countries, to get anything done, for example, if you want to open your store in some of these regions in the countries, you have to pay a fine to keep it open. If you're a bus driver, you have to pay a fine every week to keep your route. There's been something like, in the last 4 years in Guatemala, 900 bus drivers assassinated for not giving what's called in Spanish your multa. So there's those kinds of pressures. And because of impunity, it's reached such a level of interfamilial violence that it's become intolerable for so many people. And then I think there probably was reaching back into those countries, come for an opportunity. But the opportunity wasn't to make a better life in the kind of consumerist American sense, but really survival with dignity, a possibility for you and your children not to live in that kind of brutality, both in the home and in the communities in which you live. I've also written about this, to think about this for indigenous people as an ethnocide as well, because people are torn from their history, their kin, their land, everything that mattered to them. I mean, the women I work with, you have been dressing in, I mean, this may seem trivial, but it's not to them, dressing in their native indigenous costumes that mean something to who they are. It says something visible about their identity, and they come here and they never can wear them again. Mm-hmm. So these are young women that means so much, to be part of a collective as it does for indigenous people, and then to be torn apart as individuals on the run.
Right. Anna, do you want to add to that?
Yes, I do want to add to that, because I think adding to the complexity of this is that we need to remember that as a result of the wars in Central America, where people came to the United States and they had time to either acculturate or assimilate or maybe not, there was still all that discrimination that these populations face, resulting in a large number of young people living in the United States of Central American descent who were incarcerated and put in prisons. And when the United States began to go through the rosters of their prisons to find out who was there that was an undocumented immigrant from Central America, they started pulling out these. By that time, they were already hardened from years of neglect, years of not having access to education. And these were the, what we now know is Mara Salvatruchas, the MS-13. They were deported to Central America. And so then they began their gang recruitment and memberships, which started impacting the young people that are living more recently, right, as they try to compete with each other. And one of the reasons that young mothers are coming or sending their children to the United States unaccompanied is to keep those young people out of the grasp of those gang members. And I think that's been a story that's been repeated among many women time and time again. Is the reason they're coming is that they're fleeing the violence. But part of the reason there's a huge, surge in violence is because we deported a lot of people who we neglected for many years, turned to crime because of the lack of opportunities. And now we have resent them to their native lands and made things worse, compounded by the poverty with some of the trade agreements that only aggravated the poverty.
Well, and of course, that brings us up to today, and with the Trump administration talking about deporting large numbers of people I mean, of course, the Obama administration deported large numbers of people. They seemed to try to focus on people who had criminal records. But of course, there's been this criminalization of people who come and then go through the operation streamline and are then pegged as criminals and sent back. So when they come, they're criminals. And it's much easier to send them back again. But I think we what is the expectation? Does anyone have a sense of how the Trump administration is going to deal with people who are here undocumented? And Anna, you've done a lot of work on how undocumented people survive or not in this country.
Well, okay. So then there's a couple of things I think need to be said is that, there's research out there that shows how immigrants are of value to society, wherever it is that they live and work. They fuel the economy. They help create jobs. They pay taxes. They're actually a benefit to any society where they settle. There's been countless reports on the degree of crime among immigrant populations. That's also been the idea that immigrants are somehow more prone to crime, to have a criminal activity has been disputed and pretty much debunked. So you have
except by our president, who
right,
continues then, to repeat.
Sure, and this is my point exactly, is that there are, there's a rational approach to this, one that where you look at numbers, where you look at the benefits, where you have reasoned and methodological, rigorous, type of studies done that prove a point. I mean, even by the far, more conservative, sometimes their research shows the same thing as maybe some more progressive people thinking. But then you have on the other side a very irrational administration where all of those attempts to arrive at a truth are discredited. We have in front of us, we have the rationale of science, that the truth that comes with that, always trying to get at the truth. And you have an irrational president. You have irrational thinking guiding policy. And one of the important unreasoned and rational frameworks for thought is racism. There's no other way of sugarcoating it or talking about it. Racism is by definition an irrational fear about a certain group of people or person who belong to a group. It's irrational. So as long as we're at this, stalemate, we have to continue to work to get rational people elected and advocating in behalf of a more reasoned, truthful reality.
Linda, what would you like to add to that?
I agree with Anna that racism is certainly fundamental to this, but also I think we have to understand migrants, undocumented migrants, are the backbone of our economy. This is about money. As long as they're undocumented, there can be enormous wage theft, there can be abuse. Look at the farm workers. When President Reagan in the 80s declared amnesty, and so many of the undocumented farm workers were able to get papers, they vacated those fields en masse to find another job. So who do you need for our breadbasket? We need undocumented workers to provide not only the cheap labor, but the enormous revenues that accrues to these large corporations. So racism combined with class, corporate capitalism, exploitation, as well as a gendered violence, then I think you start getting the parameters of the lives that women, as we're talking about women today, but all migrants, whatever their gendered preference is, are really harshly treated, brutally treated, not only with the fear they now live with every day, but also the conditions at work.
Yeah, and those conditions, as you say, maintains this whole system of very cheap labor and very exploitable labor And I think one of the cries you hear constantly is, well, if people would just come legally, there wouldn't be a problem. And if we just had a legal way by which people could come, that would be a really rational kind of policy to have. And the fact that we don't have that policy and haven't had a policy like that for decades is a good indication, I think, of what you're saying, Linda, and Anna, that you know, this is certainly benefiting a number of people, and as long as they continue to benefit, it will continue. So I don't see much. I mean, immigration policy has never been easy in this country because of this, for all these reasons, and I certainly don't see it improving anytime soon. What do you think, Anna?
Well, you're right. It's always been difficult, and it just seems to have gotten more and more difficult as time. Plus, we had the added complexity of having state houses throughout the nation try to propose laws that will help control immigration. And, you know, we've had this huge number of laws being proposed since about 2005. I think that one of the peaks it reached in 2006 with 1,562 laws being proposed in state houses. Then we had that lull with a little with savage laws being proposed, such as SB 1070, and then in Alabama's HB 56. And then we had another peak in 2011 with like another 1,600 laws being proposed. And all of those laws are designed to make things as difficult as possible for immigrants to stay, so-called the self-deportation type of laws. They're called policies of attrition. And those laws are intended to make immigrants reconsider living in the United States. But what it does happen is that you create an environment by which more immigrants are exploitable. They move into the shadows. You damage women's ability to survive. You're reducing their health, their access to health care services, to education and schools, to any way that they have available to them to survive. So I think this is a difficult period of time, and I think it's incumbent on all of us to continue to fight back and however we can.
You're listening to 91.3 KXCI right here in Tucson. And we are celebrating International Women's Day with Maggie Zanger, Rose Lopez, Anna O'Leary, and with Linda Green in Studio 2A. Maggie, it's over to you.
Great. Thanks, Marianne. We were in the middle of talking about issues of migration, and this is so important for us in Tucson, of course, because we live on the border. We live in an area where we benefit, you know, this fabulous diversity of culture that we have here, and we embrace so much of the diversity of people coming across the border and joining our community. But we also, of course, are aware of the extreme difficulties that people face and the challenges that they face. And we were just talking before the little music break about the difficulties of getting here legally. There, you know, you can't go into an embassy in Hermosillo and ask for a visa to come and work in the United States for a year. It's just not possible. And other people come as refugees. They receive political asylum if they have a well-founded fear of persecution. That's another way to get in this country. And I think there's probably a large number of people with that well-founded fear of persecution who are not receiving asylum in this country. And Linda, you've done some work on this. Do you want to talk a little bit about what this asylum system is and how it works or not in Southern Arizona and the U.S.?
Sure. I think the asylum process for women coming from Guatemala and Central America, in particular, some from Mexico, although it's much harder, brings into sharp relief the corruption of our system. I've worked on a number of cases from Mayan indigenous women from Guatemala coming, seeking asylum with well-founded fear of persecution, and including that domestic violence is now one of the key tenets for being able to seek legitimate asylum. And I was just recently testifying in a case for a young woman who's now 24 years old, left Guatemala under very brutal circumstances of domestic violence, left without her son because she was afraid to take him, crossed the desert, asked for asylum, was put in detention center at Eloy, where she remained for well over a year, waiting for her case to come before an asylum judge. She was unable to leave the detention center because there was a $25,000 bond placed on her because the judge said she might be a flight risk. I don't know where he thought she might be fleeing to, but nonetheless, and she couldn't raise the money for that bond. So she remained in Eloy, which is owned by the Corrections Corporation of America now with under new name called Core Civic. And indeed, when you go to Eloy, it is a prison. And when you talk to the guards in Spanish, they refer to the women as reos, as prisoners. And it feels just like a prison. So this young woman stayed there. I'm really happy to report she was granted asylum. But more than half of the women who ask for asylum don't have lawyers. And without a lawyer, your chances of getting asylum are 90% to the negative. And even with a lawyer to represent you, it depends on what state you have it in. So in Arizona, for example, our granting of asylum is about 5%, where in California, it's about 85%. So there's a huge differentiation across the country in people presenting. And I testify as an expert witness in country conditions across the U.S., and it's very, very variable. But as you see, even to ask for asylum, you have to have money. The other thing that happens is when women come to the border, they ask, they have to tell the initial Border Patrol agent that indeed they're seeking asylum. They can, even if they don't, they are allowed to do it later on in the process, but it really undermines their chances. But these are women who many do not even speak Spanish, and many of the Border Patrol agents do not speak Spanish. It's not a requirement for the job, amazingly enough, on the southern border. And many of the women I work with are indigenous women that Spanish is not their first language. So you have two people of which Spanish is not their first language. And the Border Patrol agent has the authority to decide on the spot. That was a law passed in 2005 to determine whether or not that person goes in expedited removal or actually can be granted an interview with an asylum officer. So that fate is right there. And these are women who are scared, who come from extremely violent countries. Everyone's armed. They've crossed Mexico under an enormous amount of duress and assault. And they come up and meet a guy dressed in a uniform wearing a gun. And somehow they are supposed to reveal to that person all of what's happened to them and that they're seeking asylum. And so it's a system that's geared against the very people. So why was this young woman held in detention? Her crime? Asking for asylum.
Anna, do you want to add anything to that?
You've dealt probably with just a little bit. Yes, I've also been an expert witness, and I'm shocked that people requesting asylum also have to offer some type of proof, right? Some documentation that, maybe something to show that they accuse their victimizer with the police, you know. And so these are people who are not going to go to the police to accuse their abuser of what they've done, because chances are the police are corrupt, and that is certain to cause pain and injury to their family. So, you know, I think our system, as Linda just said, you know, it's corrupt. There's some pieces of it do not work well for people who are not only not Spanish speakers, but also who are afraid of the legal system to begin with. What kind of proof are you going to offer to that person that you're seeing about granting you asylum, if in fact having done that process in your home community would have certainly created more harm for you. So the system in that way is pretty rigged against those women and those families.
It's kind of a no-win situation. Rose, what would you add to that?
No, Maggie, you asked initially is how could we solve immigration, or what do we need to do as a country? And I think that to start with, I think we need to cut the red tape and give people a better and a more efficient opportunity to be able to seek the proper documents to come to the United States. Secondly, we need to stop these large corporations from bringing people into the United States illegally so that they can pay low wages and earn profits. And I think that's a good starting point for us as a nation.
Well, I think the suggestion coming out of Washington today is just to build a wall. And everyone's giggling. And of course, this is I won't put words in people's mouths, but Rose, you in particular live in a place where you have a nation of people who cross a border and who were one people until the U.S.-Mexico border was established. And I think have had a difficult time ever since then. But, I mean, this whole notion of a wall, and to their credit, the Tohono O'odham leadership was pretty strongly opposed to this idea and kind of disabused the president that this was going to be an easy thing. And the problems are endless about, and there is a wall already. And there have been so many problems, from flooding in Nogales to, the interruption of migration patterns of animals to, a nation of people who are now divided. Do you have anything to add about that?
I support the nation and holding firm to no wall. While, there is a border that is designated a line, I think the nation still extends beyond into Mexico, and there are a lot of families that continue to live there, and it makes it easier for families to stay connected. I myself have family who live on that side, and so I would hope that the nation would stand firm and not allow a wall to go up. I think, when you talk about the drug issue on the nation, I think that, the nation has really participated with the federal government in having more Border Patrol out there, having the towers up there to try to fight drugs coming into the U.S. So I think as a nation, we've demonstrated our willingness to participate in that. And I don't know that a wall is gonna help anything but only disconnect families. And, when I was serving in the military, I was stationed in Europe and in Germany. And my landlord had relatives who lived in East Berlin. And at that time, the Berlin Wall was up. And I remember my landlord, when he used to make a care package every couple of weeks, and he would put coffee and just simple stuff, and it would just be a small box, but he would send it to a cousin who lived in East Berlin, who he had not seen in years. Mm-hmm. And I used to always think, how sad, you have a cousin, you don't know him, you knew him as a child, but, you haven't seen him in 30, 40 years. And here you are making a care package, and you'll probably never, ever see him. Fortunately, the wall came down in Berlin. And I think that should be an example for us as a nation, is that wall did not accomplish what they intended for it to accomplish.
No, it didn't work for the Chinese either very well, even though that was a great wall, just like our president wants to build. Linda, what do you want to add to that?
I just wanted to add a footnote to what Rose was saying about, the drugs coming across, because, in fact, 50% of the drugs come across through the port of entry. So the stuff that's found, you know, with migrants carrying it, or, you know, the it's the kind of petty local level drug routes, and people are being paid in kind, and migrants are forced to bring it if they don't have the money they need to make it across the border into the next leg. So we don't need a wall. Maybe we need to tighten up what's happening at ports of entry. And so exactly how is it that 50% of the drugs are getting in with the ports of entry? Well, we know that there's a lot of Border Patrol, ICE agents, customs enforcement agents that are allowing that to go through. So why aren't we focusing on where some of the real efforts are? And it's we're not talking about marijuana. We're talking about cocaine, black tar heroin, methamphetamine. That's where the money is.
We are getting near the end of our discussion here. Anna, do you want to say one
wrap just
one
really
up,
quick
final thing,
to,
and then we'll look to, forward for a second.
Okay, to piggyback on what's been said already, but 50% of all people living in the United States without documents came through the regular port of entry, right? So that means that 50% of all undocumented immigrants, only about 52% are Mexican immigrants. So I guess maybe the only thing I can say is, you know, build a wall. That's a simple solution provided by, you know, simple minds.
Well, that says it. That does say it all. Again, we're wrapping up here, though. This is International Women's Day on KXCI Community Radio. And we've had a great discussion with Linda Green from Latin American Studies at the University of Arizona, and in anthropology at the Center for Latin American Studies, and Ana Ochoa O'Leary, who's with Mexican American Studies, and Rose Lopez, who's the CEO of a nonprofit organization that provides developmental health services. And I think let's, in the last couple minutes, let's look forward. Is there anything positive we can talk about? What can we all do here in Tucson, Arizona to help our migrating sisters, and to help indigenous people who are struggling, and people of color, and people who are really, I think, going to have a hard time in the next, my God, 4 years. What can we do? What's happening here in Tucson that we can get involved in? Who's got the first idea? Rose, what you got?
Actually, I have a couple of things, Maggie. The first thing, you know, the YWCA is really, after the Women's March, have 10 actions in the first 100 days. And I really think that people should visit the YWCA's website and really get involved, because they're on it. I mean, they're really on it. They're sending out emails, and they're rallying people. And it's a great way for us to continue this discussion and ensure that, you know, we're holding our politicians accountable. Secondly, I think people need to support those local nonprofits who are helping women. You know, I serve on the board of the Women's Foundation, and I chose that board specifically because they do look to support women, and their belief is that if women thrive, communities will thrive. And so I really think for all those nonprofits out there who are working with women, we really need to support those nonprofits.
Great. And I'm gonna add to that, a nonprofit working with refugees. We have, unfortunately, there'll be fewer in the future, but we have a number of refugees here from who have been escaping the wars in Syria and Iraq with ISIS. And these are people, and a lot of refugees also from Sudan, Somalia. These are people who really do need our support and our help also. And locally, there are several organizations, of course, the International Rescue Committee, but others. So, again, let's support women. Let's support our sisters from other countries. Linda, what else have you got?
I don't have any particular group that I want to talk about, but I would say that if all of us did one thing, whatever, you know, whether it's the food bank for homeless women, for migrant women, women seeking asylum, whatever, needing health care, whatever, if we all just choose one thing to put some time into all the time locally, then I think we can really foster a community that takes human rights seriously.
Any parting couple of
well, just
30 seconds
I,
of words?
Right. Well, you know, I think if we all do our part in bringing awareness to women's roles and highlighting those roles, I mean, it's shown that women, Mexican women, are more likely to send consistently the remittances. They send more money than compared to men. I think that as long as we keep that information focused and on target, then the more we bring to focus women's roles, I think we can help in that way.
Great. Lots of great ideas, lots of good energy. Thank you all for being here today and helping us to celebrate International Women's Day and No Working Wednesday on March 8th. Thank you all. Thank you, KXCI, for having us. Thank you, everyone out there listening to us. We'll see you next year.